Well, thank you, Tony. It's a great pleasure, of course, to be back here in Santa Barbara, where I was a mere 3 years ago, actually gainfully employed here. The unusual situation is that I'm talking about an area in which all the interesting results occurred 3 years ago. So all the talks that I gave then bear a great resemblance to the talk I am about to give right now. But I'm assured by many people that no one remembers any of the talks that I gave 3 years ago, so I can safely repeat myself. The title, the preposterous universe part of the title, is of course an homage to the string theorists who are so popular here at the ITP, who have given to the world a popular book called The Elegant Universe by Brian Greene. And we like to point out that only to a string theorist does the universe look elegant at all, because they don't actually look at the universe. If you actually go out there and observe the universe, it's a horrible mess. It's a preposterous mess. So we're going to talk about the actual universe, even through the simplistic squinting eyes of a cosmologist, is kind of a messy place. So, as I said, not a lot of new results here, but many failed ideas and provocative suggestions and so forth. So here's a long list of people with whom I've been talking about these things and who made various plots for the talk. So the summary is simple. The big news is that we now know what the universe is made of. This is the pie chart representing the universe. This 4%, the yellow 4%, is all that we have ever seen of the universe. Every atom, every molecule, every particle we've ever detected is this little wedge. We also have the dark sector. 96% of the universe is dark. And we now know that the dark sector comes in at least two subsectors, dark matter in red and dark energy in blue. So this makes no sense, this division of stuff into the universe, especially because, well, for two reasons. One, why should these three very different sets of things be approximately equal in amounts in the universe? And secondly, why now? Since the shape of this pie chart changes with time, it will look very different in the past and the future. So why do we get so lucky as to have these three things being of interestingly equal magnitudes? So the next step that we have to do, and I'm not going to tell you how to do it here, but provoke you into trying to do it yourselves, is to move from this inventory, what is the universe made of, to understanding why it is made of this stuff. No one has any ideas about this, which leads us open to a lot of good questions. So let's remind ourselves of the basics of cosmology, which is, in some sense, the simplest science, even though it does the whole universe, because the universe, over very large scales, is a very simple place. Over very large scales, the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, which is a fancy mathematical way of saying it's the same everywhere. It's the same every direction you look in, the same every point that you visit. And it's expanding in time. So a description of the universe includes a description of space at one moment in time, which is the same everywhere, so you really only have to give me the description of space at one point at one moment in time, and that description just means what is the curvature of space? Is it positively curved, negatively curved, or zero? And then it gets bigger. It's currently getting bigger anyway. It could get smaller in the past or in the future. So what is the relative size of the universe at different moments in time? So here's an artist's impression of some galaxies in the universe. Those galaxies move apart. The galaxies themselves stay the same size. They move apart from each other, and we interpret that as the expansion of the universe. So the scale factor, A of t, is the name that we give to the thing that tells us the relative size, the relative distances between these galaxies. What we know about the scale factor is that, number one, it's getting bigger. So right now we live here. The universe is expanding. A is getting bigger with time. And in the past, it was really, really small. It was small enough that it's practically zero size compared to what it was today, and we call that moment the Big Bang. We don't know what happens exactly at the Big Bang, but we know the universe started from a very hot, dense state. We see the relics of that state in the microwave background and in light elements. So given that kinematical framework, we plug in the dynamical equations given to us by general relativity. And that is the Friedmann equation right here. So this relates the expansion rate, which is given by the Hubble parameter h, a dot over a, to the energy density of the universe, rho, which is assumed to be the same everywhere throughout space at any given moment in time because of the homogeneity and isotropy, and the curvature, kappa. So the spatial curvature is either plus positive number, negative number, or zero. You have an energy density. If you know those two things, you can solve for what the expansion rate will be. And furthermore, if you know how rho evolves as a function of the scale factor, you can solve for the complete history. You can solve for h everywhere throughout space and time. So that's what cosmologists want to know. Here's the equation governing the history of the universe, past and future. We can solve this equation if you give me rho as a function of A. So what is the stuff that makes up the universe? What is it made of? And in particular, the thing that we care about its makeup is how does it evolve with time or with the scale factor? Well, what are some candidates? What are some kinds of things that might make up the universe? The simplest example is what a cosmologist calls matter. Now, you may think you know what matter is, but it's a technical term in cosmology, and the technical term is stuff that is slowly moving compared to the speed of light, a set of particles, for example, whose peculiar velocities are very small compared to the speed of light. In that case, the energy density of those particles just comes from E equals mc squared. This comes from the number density of the particles times their individual masses. So the energy density in what a cosmologist calls matter just scales as the number density, because the mass remains constant, unless you do something tricky. And therefore, the energy density of matter goes as a to the minus 3, is the scale factor to the minus 3, because the volume of the universe in space goes up as a cubed, as the universe expands, therefore the number density goes down. So here is a possible answer to the question, how can the energy density of the universe evolve? If it's made of matter, which is stars, dust, slowly moving elementary particles, then rho will go as a to the minus 3. As an alternative, you can consider radiation, which is, to a cosmologist, anything that travels at or near the speed of light. Because then it is not the rest mass that is dominating the energy density. It is the wavelength, right? E equals h nu. And as the universe expands, wavelengths can get stretched. Each individual radiation particle, whether it's a photon or a neutrino, will lose energy as the universe expands as 1 over a. Furthermore, of course, if you're not creating or destroying particles, then the number density still goes down as a to the minus 3. So for radiation, the energy density goes as a to the minus 4 overall. It's a to the minus 3 for the number density, a to the minus 1 for the wavelength. Today, we have very excellent reason to believe that the universe has much more matter in it than radiation, 10 to the 4 times or 10 to the 3 times as much. So radiation was important in the early universe because when a was much smaller, rho sub r was dominating over matter. But today, the matter is believed to be more important. So we're skipping a lot of actual observational history here, but to tell you the results, the first surprise is that most of the universe is not made up of the stuff that you actually see, galaxies, gas, and dust, and things like that. The stuff that dominates the universe is something which we call dark matter, which is both invisible and transparent. In other words, it has never been, as far as we know, no photon has ever been deflected by a dark matter particle. If you count, you get about 5 times as much dark matter as ordinary matter. That is the conclusion that cosmologists have reached over 100 years of very hard work. So how do you know, if you can't see it? When you have popular talks about cosmology, they say, you know, you guys are just have just let your imaginations run free. If you can't see something, how do you possibly know it's there? So the answer to this is just to wave your hand, and you realize that you feel the influence of the air inside the room against your hand. Just because you don't see the air doesn't mean it's not there. Likewise, you feel the influence of the dark matter. That's how you know it's there. You feel it, you see it pushing around particles and making them move because you feel its gravitational influence. We know the dark matter is not baryons, both because of nucleosynthesis, as we'll talk about later, and because nowadays, from measurements of the cosmic microwave background. That is what convinces us that about 5 times as much matter as we see is some stuff that we've never detected before. Not just dark stars or anything like that, but a truly new kind of elementary particle. But even though there's 5 times as much dark matter as ordinary matter, there's still not enough in some well-defined sense. So what do I mean by that? It's convenient to normalize the energy density rho by multiplying by this factor to create something called the density parameter omega. That's because if you take the Friedman equation and use the definition of omega, you find that this measure of the density of the universe corresponds directly to the overall geometry given by the curvature kappa. In the sense that if this number omega is greater than 1, then kappa is a positive number, so space is positively curved, like a sphere. If omega equals 1, then kappa has to equal 0, because you get h squared equals 8 pi g over 3 times rho, and the universe is flat. So that's just like good old ordinary Euclidean three-dimensional space. Whereas if omega is less than 1, then kappa has to be less than 0, and you get a negatively curved space like a potato chip or a saddle. So if you count the energy density in ordinary matter plus dark matter and add it all up, multiply by 8 pi g, divide by 3 h squared, you get omega matter is 0.3. So that's a little surprising, because omega matter being 0.3 is not something that would remain constant as the universe expands. It would change. In the past, it would have been very close to 1, in the future, it would be very close to 0. So that's a bit of a surprise that we caught it there at the right time. It would have been more natural to have an omega which was close to 1. So this came as a surprise to cosmologists, and they tried to sort of, there was a lot of denial in the theoretical cosmology community for many years about that result. So our wishes were fulfilled. I was one of the people who didn't like the fact that omega was 0.3, and fortunately we found a way out of it, which is something called dark energy. The difference between dark energy and dark matter is that the dark energy is more or less constant everywhere throughout space and time. I can only say more or less, not because I've detected variations of it from place to place, but because we just haven't measured it that precisely. The characteristic feature of dark matter is that it doesn't change a lot from place to place. It's smoothly distributed through space, and very slowly, if at all, with time. So maybe it's perfectly constant. The paradigmatic candidate for dark energy is vacuum energy. The idea that everywhere in space, if you take some little volume and remove from it all the photons and all the atoms and all the dark matter particles that you can possibly remove, and ask the question, what is the energy remaining in that volume? There's no reason whatsoever why that answer should be zero. In general relativity, it's a completely undetermined parameter. In quantum field theory, it's a calculable number, but once again, there's nothing that says that it should be zero. So that is the vacuum energy density, or equally good, Einstein's cosmological constant, lambda. So it's the idea that every little cubic centimeter is just vibrating with some sort of energy density. And that's a measurable parameter. We have to go find out what it is. Well, how do we do that? How would we know if there were dark energy? Well, it does two important things. It contributes to the energy density, and therefore to the curvature, so we can go measure the curvature of space. And it also affects the Friedman equation, and therefore the expansion rate of the universe. If you take the Friedman equation for a, let's say for a flat universe, if you just assume that kappa is zero, then A dot is proportional to A times the square root of rho. That's just what you get by taking the Friedman equation and multiplying by A squared. So if rho is approximately constant, A is increasing with time, and therefore A dot is increasing with time, and you get an expanding and accelerating universe. As opposed to a matter-dominated universe, where the square root of rho goes as A to the minus 3 halves, so A times A to the minus 3 halves is A to the minus 1 half, and as the universe expands, it decelerates. So there's a very characteristic signal of the existence of dark energy, namely that the redshift of distant galaxies should be speeding up with time, not slowing down. So this is something we can go look for. Let's look for the first effect first, the geometry of space. This is actually in backwards chronological order, but it makes sense this way. How do you measure the geometry of space? Well, nature has given us a standard ruler to measure across cosmological distances, namely fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. So here is the leftover energy density in photons from the Big Bang when it was very hot and dense. It's very smooth. It's smooth to 1 part in 10 to the 5, but not perfectly so. There are 1 part in 10 to the 5 fluctuations. So you can map out those fluctuations. In this case, these are mapped out by a balloon experiment called Boomerang, which is partially done here at UCSB. And you take the Fourier transform of the map you get. Just by looking at this, once you've played this game for a while, you can Fourier transform this map by eye, right? You can see that there's a characteristic size of these splotches. The resolution of the telescope was much better than this characteristic size here. So you see the fact that these blobs are about that big, both the dark ones and the bright ones, is not an accident. There are not bigger blobs, and there are not much, much smaller blobs. They would have shown up in this map if they had been there. If you want to know how big those blobs are on the sky, that's the moon right there. That's the size of the full moon, about half a degree. So these blobs are about 1 degree on the sky. And we know how big they were in physical scale because we know where these blobs come from. They are remnants of oscillating acoustic waves in the photon-baryon fluid in the early universe, taken as a snapshot when the universe is 300,000 years old, and it's easy to show with some equations, therefore you expect these things to be 300,000 light years across. So if you know how big they really are, you know their angular size as compared to the moon, you can tell the geometry through which the photons traveled to get to us from the early universe, from the universe when it was 300,000 years old. The answer is the universe is flat. Therefore, omega total is equal to 1. So if omega matter is 0.3, something else is making omega total be 1. We confirm the fact that that is dark energy by the fact that the universe is, in fact, accelerating. And this is the result that was discovered first. How do you do that? You look at high redshift supernovae, which are not quite standard candles. They're not quite all of the same brightness, but they are standardizable candles in the sense that if you follow the evolution of each individual supernova, as it goes up in brightness and then declines, that evolution is correlated with the overall brightness of the object. If it goes down more slowly, then it was brighter. If it goes down rapidly, then it was dimmer to begin with. Given that information, you can measure many supernovae at high redshifts, higher than 0.1 or 0.2, all the way up to 1. And you can look at their absolute bright, at their apparent brightness, you can look at their behavior, you can figure out their absolute brightness, and therefore how far away physically they are, and map that out. That's the vertical scale here. Map that out versus redshift, compare it to different cosmologies. So this line down here would be a cosmology in which omega matter was 1 and there was no cosmological constant. It does not fit the data. This cosmology is one with no cosmological constant, no vacuum energy, and omega matter being 0.3, which is what it would have to be if there were no dark energy at all, and that's this straight line. And you look at these points, every individual point is close enough, but the whole collection of points is certainly not consistent with that straight line here. What you conclude is the line that fits is the one in which you've included a hefty dose of vacuum energy or dark energy. There must be something that is not going away as the universe accelerates, as the universe expands. So here's the concordance. Here's both the supernova observations and the microwave background observations on the same plot. So the parameter space here is omega matter and omega lambda, the dark energy or the vacuum energy. We don't include radiation because we've measured how much radiation there is. We think it's much less than omega matter. The supernovae are telling us that there's an appreciable amount of omega lambda. The microwave background is telling us that omega total is approximately 1. So omega matter plus omega lambda is close to this dashed line right there. And the agreement is over here, with omega matter being about 0.3, omega lambda being about 0.7, which is good news because we independently measured omega matter to be 0.3 just from the dynamics of galaxies and the particles moving around them. There's a third set of constraints here that says that omega matter is between 0.2 and 0.4. So if you don't want to believe that that's the universe in which we live, it's not enough to disbelieve the supernova observations. You have to simultaneously disbelieve either the microwave background or the direct measurements of omega matter. So here's what we end up with. A universe which is 5% ordinary matter. 4% is actually closer to the truth, but 5% sounds a little bit more poetic. 25% dark matter and 70% dark energy. And so this pie chart summarizes the results of 100 years of work in cosmology. But it makes no sense. I mean, it's a tremendous accomplishment to have done this, but we don't come close to understanding it right now. So here are some questions that we'd like to know the answer to. Why is the dark energy density small but not quite zero? Before we discovered the dark energy, we already knew the dark energy density should be really big, but it was much smaller than it should be. Therefore, it was easiest to guess that something was multiplying it by exactly zero. Now that turns out not to be true. The thing that is multiplying what we predict by what we observe is a factor of 10 to the 120. So even by cosmological standards, that is a very bad disagreement. We are off in our prediction by 120 orders of magnitude. Okay. Given that, why is it that we observe the dark energy to be important just now? Remember that the ratio of these things is about going like A cubed. The dark energy density does not go away as the universe expands, whereas the matter density does. So we had to be preposterously lucky to be born at a time when these two numbers were of order the same order of magnitude. For that matter, questions that we won't even get into here because they've been around for a long time and very little progress has been made. Why are the amounts of ordinary and dark matter comparable? And for that matter, why is there not as much antimatter as matter? These are questions that go back a longer time, so they're less interesting to talk about right now. All right, so I'm going to try to say in slightly stronger words why these are problems, and then we're just going to give a very superficial tour of some of the proposed solutions, if you can call them that. So the problems. Why is the vacuum energy so small? It would have been perfectly sensible to have a huge vacuum energy compared to what we have today. There's no reason why the vacuum energy should not be up to the Planck scale, characteristic of quantum gravity. So here's a simple reasoning. Consider a single scalar field. So there's some field that takes some value everywhere throughout space-time. There are such fields lying around. The Higgs field is a good example. Those fields have an energy density. It's a kinetic energy, phi dot squared, a gradient energy as it changes from place to place, so this is the spatial gradient of phi squared, and a potential energy via phi, some function which we might not know. There's a simple solution to the equations of motion for this scalar field in which phi itself is a constant, and therefore phi dot is zero, grad phi is zero, and via phi is some constant. So you have some potential energy via phi, and field is just sitting there, not moving in its potential. That's a solution. The point is, we could pick a via phi for which that number was precisely zero. We could pick it to be a big number, we could pick it to be a small number. But there's nothing special about zero. There's no good thing that happens if you pick that via phi to be exactly zero. And therefore, we don't know why the observed number would be 120 orders of magnitude less than the number we apparently have, than we theorized it should be. To be a little bit more sophisticated, there's another reason to believe in vacuum energy, which are vacuum fluctuations. If you take a quantum field theory, which we think accurately describes the world on all of the scales we've ever observed, every Fourier mode of a quantum field acts like a harmonic oscillator and has a corresponding zero-point energy, just like a harmonic oscillator does. Here is a classical harmonic oscillator. It has an energy of zero. If I tune the potential for the oscillator to have a minimum at zero, then the particle can sit there with no kinetic energy and zero energy. But then I quantize the same system, I find the ground state wave function has a minimum energy which is greater than zero, which is 1/2 h bar omega. So every Fourier mode of every quantum field has that much energy, where omega counts as the frequency of the field. So you integrate over all those, and you say, what is the total vacuum energy? And it's an infinite number. Don't let anyone tell you any different. As far as we can tell, the number is infinity. Of course, you don't quite believe that because you've integrated over modes which are much smaller than the Planck length, and we don't believe that we understand anything about physics below the Planck length. So you say, all right, I'll cut it off at modes that big. That gives me an energy density, in theory, which is the Planck scale to the fourth power, and that's where I got this number, 120 orders of magnitude bigger than the vacuum energy scale we observe. And here's the profound fact. If you wanted to throw away the modes that were on sufficiently short scales that they disagreed with observation and say, well, maybe we just don't understand physics on scales that are that small, the relevant scale is 1 millimeter. So vacuum fluctuations on all scales smaller than 1 millimeter, as far as experiment is concerned, do not gravitate. They don't exert a gravitational force. They do lots of other things. I mean, you observe them, they're there in the Lamb shift, the Casimir effect, stuff like that. But they don't have any gravity, and nobody knows why. In other words, it's not a purely ultraviolet problem. You can't just twiddle with physics at the Planck scale and make this thing go away. On the other hand, maybe you just have no clue what you're doing. I mean, we did get an infinite answer after all. Who says we had a right to cut it off? There's a better set of theories called supersymmetry in which you can at least get a sensible answer. So the good news is that if you live in a perfectly supersymmetric state, one in which every boson had a fermion partner of the same mass and couplings and so forth, you could calculate the vacuum energy density and it would be exactly zero. Those positive fluctuations you get from all the bosons would be canceled by negative fluctuations you get from the fermions, and the cosmological constant would vanish. The bad news is that we don't live in such a state. We don't see an electron which looks like a boson, has a charge -1 and a mass of 0.5 MeV and so forth. There's no such particle. So supersymmetry has to be broken. We think that it's broken at least at a scale of 10 to the 12 electron volts, 10 to the 3 GeV, because we haven't observed it yet at Fermilab and places like that. The good news is that this helps the cosmological constant problem. Without supersymmetry, it was a matter of 120 orders of magnitude that we could not explain. Here, in supersymmetry, broken at 10 to the 12 electron volts, the discrepancy between theory and observation is only 60 orders of magnitude. So it made the problem only half as bad on a log scale. So that's an improvement. But the bad news is that the previous calculation was just a hand-wavy thing which we couldn't believe. This calculation actually makes sense. It gave us a finite answer which we have no right to disbelieve. And it's off by 60 orders of magnitude. So that's a problem worthy of our attention. And therefore, I'm going to go to a different problem because I have no idea what the solution to that problem is. The next problem is, why are today the vacuum and matter energy densities comparable? So here is that same parameter space, omega matter and omega lambda again, trying to emphasize the fact that the points that you pick on this space, you don't stay there once you pick them. These little arrows tell you as the universe expands how these two numbers change with time. The claim is that we live here. Omega matter is 0.3, omega lambda is 0.7. So we are on a journey from very close to omega matter equals 1, omega lambda equals 0, to omega matter equals 0, omega lambda equals 1. So we're going from here to there. What right do we have to be in between those points? Well, it depends on what is the time scale of the age of the universe compared to whatever microphysical time scale set the initial conditions. So to give you a view of how unlikely it is, here is a plot of the total energy density in radiation plus matter versus the cosmological constant on a log scale from the Planck time, electroweak symmetry breaking, nucleosynthesis to today. And what you see is, early in the universe's history, omega lambda was zero. We were very close to that point, omega lambda equals zero, omega matter equals one. And at some point, we leap up very rapidly, and from thence on, we're stuck at omega lambda equals zero. So if you want to believe that we live in this universe that the pie chart describes, you have to believe we just got lucky enough to be born right there. In the history of cosmology, we make a lot of progress by never believing that we're lucky, by believing that the place and time which we live in the universe is completely representative and not special, but this result seems to be claiming that it's special. All right, so what might be going on? Like I told you, I already warned you, I don't have any good answers. I'm going to give you a long list of bad answers, hoping that will compensate in some way. So the possibilities for what is going on is that, well, maybe we just haven't figured out how to do the calculation yet, but there is some calculation which gives us the true vacuum energy in terms of the other constants of nature, and we get a small but non-zero number. That's a possibility. Another possibility is that the true vacuum energy is zero, but we don't live in the true vacuum. We are stuck in some metastable state with a small non-zero vacuum energy. A third possibility is we don't even live in any vacuum at all, namely that we are in a state which is not static, that slowly the energy density of empty space is changing with time, and that's something we could hope to detect. Or maybe that the framework in which we're working is wrong. Maybe the Friedman equation is wrong or something more dramatic is going on. So let's look at these one by one. So is it possible that the true vacuum energy could be some calculable non-zero number? Well, here are two equations, either one of which gives you the right answer. One is that the supersymmetry breaking scale that I told you about of 1 TeV is the geometric mean of the Planck scale and the vacuum energy scale. If I define the vacuum energy scale to be the fourth root of the energy density in the vacuum. So this is 10 to the 27 EV, this is 10 to the minus 3 EV, that gives us 10 to the 12 electron volts.
You should tell the non-experts.
The square root goes all the way over there to get the dimensions right. That's just a computer glitch there. So this is a true fact about those three numbers, that one of them is the geometric mean of the other two. Here's another true fact, that if I take this 10 to the 3 electron volts number and I raise it to the fourth power, it is e to the minus 2 over alpha times the Planck mass to the fourth, where alpha is 1 over 137. Okay? So this looks kind of like formulae that you see in supergravity sometimes. This looks kind of like formulae that you see in gauge theory sometimes. But beyond that statement, there's nothing else I can say.
What's the argument for the two?
Well, that otherwise you'd be off by 60 orders of magnitude. What do you mean? What is the argument for any of these equations? The whole point of the transparency is there is no argument. If anyone in the room has an argument in favor of either one of these equations, let me know and collaborate, because it would be an important step forward. We're right now in the numerology stage. We have no knowledge invested in these equations whatsoever. We're looking for a formula that would predict something like this. Meanwhile, the string theorists find it hard to even to get a solution to string theory where there's any positive vacuum energy, much less a calculable one. Hopefully, all of these problems are related to each other, right? If we find a way to get such solutions, then we'll be able to calculate the number. Perfectly reasonable people whose salaries are much higher than mine are found to take solace in the anthropic principle. So what does that mean? Let your mind expand to include the possibility that the vacuum energy takes on different values in different parts of the universe. Maybe different branches of the wave function, maybe just physically distinct parts of space. With uniform probability. So if you pick a point in the universe and ask what is the vacuum energy, you have equal probability of getting any number. Okay? And imagine that everything else remains constant. So the fine structure constant, the mass of the electron, what we know about the history of galaxy formation and so forth, that all remains the same. Then ask the question, what do most galaxies in this ensemble of possibilities observe? And the claim is that most galaxies would observe a vacuum energy whose an absolute value is between 1 and 10 times the matter density, which is exactly what we do. We observe this number to be 2 or 3, perhaps. So the claim is the anthropic principle makes a prediction that has been proven right, and we should all, you know, award prizes to the people who did it. Of course, in order to get this right prediction, you have to make these rather large metaphysical assumptions about the nature of space and time on huge scales. And you have to make some, you have to play some games with how to calculate probabilities in infinitely big spaces. But nevertheless, this is a better result than anybody else has in this game. I didn't mention observers. The question was a statement, which is that I hadn't mentioned the fact that this is conditional on the existence of observers. But I didn't mention observers. I just said most galaxies would be in a place in the universe where you'd measure that. Full stop. Right. The condition, it's not the condition of the existence of galaxies, it is you integrate over all galaxies what they observe, and the distribution is peaked at that.
turn it around and say that it's not bigger, then there's just no value.
Right. So if the vacuum energy had a different value, if it were a large negative value, there was not enough time in the universe for galaxies to form. If it's a large positive value, it expands very fast and the galaxies get blown apart. If it's close to zero, well, just the percentage chance that it's close to zero, you know, between minus 1 and 1, is just less than the chance that it's between minus 10 to 1 or 1 to 10. Was another question? I don't even know how they took the whole age thing into account, to tell you the truth. I worry that they didn't do it correctly and asked only for people, for galaxies that were 13 billion years old or something like that, which is the wrong question to ask, but I don't know the answer to that.
But of course, the CMB, you also can make some assumptions about how large are the quote-unquote parts of the universe, right?
Are they what?
I mean, there must be assumptions on how large the size of the parts of the universe are. I mean, we're getting in trouble with CMB.
I don't think so, but I'm ashamed of you people asking more questions about this slide than any other slide I've shown you so far. So I'm going to just move on.
My first salary is a lot higher than yours.
Well, that's a hint. I should give this talk at Chicago, I think.
By the way, that's a good definition of reasonable.
Yes, very much. So, I mean, sadly, we stop there. I don't know anything more to say about the possibility that we live in a true vacuum. Maybe we live in a false vacuum about which I have even less to say, because it really doesn't change any of the important problems very much. If we live in a false vacuum, that means that there's some scalar field or some effective order parameter that has some potential energy as a function of the expectation value of the field, where there's a local minimum which is not a global minimum. So we could live down there, but in fact we do live right there for some cosmological reason. The only reason you would consider this is if you were really wedded to the idea that the thing that is making the vacuum energy small makes it precisely zero. And it's an accident of history that we live not quite in that true vacuum. However, you've replaced the question of why is the actual vacuum energy small but non-zero by the question why is the splitting between the state in which we live and the actual vacuum energy small but not zero? Why is this number in this arbitrary potential 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth power rather than some much bigger number? And what is worse, there's no way to test this hypothesis just from making observations. If you invented a theory of everything that predicted this, maybe you would begin to believe it, but the observational signature of living in that false vacuum is exactly the same as living in a true vacuum. So, therefore, what cosmologists do is to try to go to the next interesting thing, which would have an observational signature, imagining that the dark energy was dynamical, was that it was slowly varying with time, but it was nevertheless varying. So the simplest example, but by no means the only one, is a slowly rolling scalar field. So a scalar field whose potential does not have a minimum, or at least not one that we're sitting in, but whose slope is very, very shallow so that we don't roll down very quickly. Therefore, in this scenario, the kinetic energy of this field is small but not zero. The potential energy is much bigger than the kinetic energy, so it acts almost like an ordinary cosmological constant. So the good things about the scenario is that you could imagine that somewhere in the future you would reach a point where the vacuum energy were in fact zero, which might be good. It's observationally interesting because you have now a slightly time-dependent vacuum energy and therefore one more number you can hope to observationally constrain, the amount of the energy and also its time dependence, its first derivative. It might be consistent with string theory, because if the thing that string theorists are really having a problem with is getting a universe which forever and ever is accelerating and looks like De Sitter space, this universe can stop accelerating sometime in the far future, and maybe that's an easier solution to get. Best of all, but not yet achieved, is the idea that you could pick the dynamics for this scalar field in such a way so that it would tune itself, rather than us having to tune it, so that dark energy would take over today. And I'll talk about a couple possibilities along those lines. But first, we should point out the bad parts. One thing is that the mass of this scalar field, in order to be sufficiently slowly rolling, has to be of order 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. So for the particle physicists in the audience, you know there's something called the hierarchy problem. The mass of the Higgs is of order 100 GeV or something like that, right? 10 to the 11 electron volts. And this 10 to the 11 electron volts number is considered to be really unnaturally small, because it should be up there at the gut scale or the Planck scale. And here, you need to invent a scalar field whose mass is 10 to the minus 33 electron volts, so that's even smaller, and therefore a correspondingly harder problem to explain. And it should already have been detected. Even if you try to make the scalar field not communicate with any of the particles in the standard model, we live in a low energy effective field theory, and there should be loop effects which do connect it to the particles in the standard model. And even if those connections are very weak, they accumulate over long distances, and this is a long distance effect, so it should have been observed by now. That problem is not as bad. You only need to tune things to about 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 4, but still, it's a sort of a tuning. So the observational thing that you do is you characterize all these possible sets of things that were characterized by V of phi into a smaller number of possibilities that we might hope to observationally distinguish. So we characterize different forms of dynamical dark energy by giving their equation of state. This is the pressure in terms of the energy density. So for matter, for particles which are slowly moving, the pressure vanishes. So this parameter W equals zero. For radiation, radiation has pressure. If you have a box of photons, there is an amount of pressure which is equal to one-third the energy density, so W is one-third. For a cosmological constant, it turns out, for honest vacuum energy, which makes the universe accelerate, W equals minus one. It turns out to be more negative values of W tend to make the universe accelerate or come closer to accelerating. So what you do is you take as given the result that the universe is spatially flat, that omega total equals 1. You don't have to do this, but this makes your life a little bit easier. So omega total equals 1, and we divide omega total into omega matter and omega x, or omega dark energy, or whatever you want to have it. And that is this stuff that we have up here. And then you plot that versus W, the effective equation of state parameter for this new dark energy candidate. So 0 would be matter, minus 1 would be a cosmological constant. The tilted dark curves here are the constraints from supernova observations. These curves here are constraints from large-scale structure in the microwave background. So you combine them together to find a joint likelihood set of curves. And what you see is that the best fit is something where omega matter is about 0.32 or something like that, and W is minus 1, so an honest-to-God cosmological constant. But there's still some room to play here. For some reason, they plotted curves which are half sigma contours, not one sigma contours. This is 2 sigma away, and that's a W equals minus 0.6. You might certainly hope with future experiments to distinguish between 0.6 and 1.
If you let omega be less than minus 1, does the data actually prefer a value less than minus 1?
Mildly. Yeah, I'm going to get to that, actually. In fact, I'm going to get to that right now. Should we consider W less than minus 1? So all of these plots you see in the literature stop at minus 1. And why is that? I think that is my contribution to the entire field, that the plots stop at minus 1. Because the first such plot was done in a paper by the high redshift supernova team. And they made this plot, and they stopped at minus 1, and they realized they weren't quite sure why they stopped at minus 1. So they called me up, because I was friends with them, and they said, is it okay if we stop our plot at minus 1? And I said, yes, I hereby invoke the null dominant energy condition, which is something you find in general relativity, which is supposed to be true if you read, say, Hawking and Ellis's book. If you want an unknown form of energy which is guaranteed not to transmit information faster than the speed of light, you should invoke this energy condition right here. In terms of rho and p, it says that the energy density is less than in magnitude the pressure, or equal, and that rho plus p is greater than zero. So if you have W less than minus 1, the pressure is bigger than the energy density, so that's ruled out. If you had such a candidate, you would worry that you were having energy densities moving around by greater than the speed of light. So I said, yes, you're allowed to do that, and they put my name at the end of the paper as the 21st author. And every paper since then has stopped at W equals minus 1. Yeah, I know. Well, so I'm going back on it. I'm changing my mind now. Just like Einstein had his greatest blunder and Hawking had his greatest blunder. This was my greatest blunder so far, but I'm young yet. I have a chance for much greater blunders than this. The point is, I think my current belief is that we are completely clueless about what the dark energy is, and we have no right to be invoking any classical energy condition whatsoever. I mean, as a purely observational problem, we should see what fits the data the best. This point right here with W equals minus 1 and omega matter is 0.3 fits the data very well, but perhaps improvements in the data will actually make that point fit less well than a W less than minus 1. So you might want to ask yourself, can you invent simple field theories in which W would be less than minus 1? And so here is a simple field theory in which W would be a negative number, less than minus 1. Take a potential for a field, and this is very small because only for the experts, a little aside. Take a potential which is a Gaussian, okay? So it would tend to roll away to plus or minus infinity if you just put a particle in that potential. but put a minus sign in front of the kinetic energy term in the Lagrangian. So it has a backwards kinetic energy. So therefore, this scalar field rolls up the hill and stops right there, and it oscillates back and forth at the top of the hill because it has a negative sign kinetic term. You might worry that there's some instabilities in here, but it's really just like a particle rolling in an upside-down potential with an ordinary kinetic energy. And in this period where the particle is rolling up the hill, both its kinetic energy and its potential energy are increasing.
But the Hamiltonian is not bounded alone.
No, fair enough. You have to expand your mind here. I mean, we're trying to think outside the box.
Okay, think outside the box.
The question is there any observational evidence that that theory isn't right? That's the question you have to ask. Any other questions will be beaten down. Not that it's especially helpful to do that. I mean, I don't know why you'd want to do that. I'm just pointing out that we should first actually see what the observations tell us, and then we can go build models after that. Okay. So one of the reasons we invoked this is because we wanted to solve the coincidence problem. Why is the energy density today close to the energy density in matter? Well, so a step in this direction was taken by investigating things called tracker potentials, e to the minus phi and 1 over phi. And potentials like this have the property that the energy density in the dark energy, in the scalar field, can always remain proportional to whatever other thing is dominating the energy density of the universe. So if the universe is radiation dominated, the scalar field has an energy density which goes as a to the minus 4. If the universe is matter dominated, it goes as a to the minus 3. So that is interesting because it ties the dynamics of the dark energy to the dynamics of the ordinary stuff. But the problem is it does not make the universe accelerate. You need something that does not go away as a to the minus 3 in the current universe. That's the whole point. So you need to play with the tracker potentials in some way. And the potentials that people have written down which try to play with this, in my mind anyway, look just as fine-tuned as anybody else's potential. So you haven't really made much progress that way. The problem is that we're trying to say something about why the dark energy should take over today. So you have to first answer the question, what is so special about today? So in order to explain why something special is happening, there has to be something else that is special that would make it happen. I hope that made at least some sense. I know of only two possibilities along these lines. One is that the thing that is special about today is that we're not so far away from matter radiation equality. Matter radiation equality was at a redshift of 10 to the 4. And you say, well, that sounds like it's a long way away to me, but everything in the problem is evolving as a power law, so maybe you really should be thinking on a log scale, and this is only a factor of 4. Once again, we're thinking outside the box. The other possibility that I know of is perhaps the acceleration happens 10% of the time. Maybe the universe accelerates sometimes, doesn't accelerate other times, and we just happen to be lucky at the 1 in 10 level, rather than the 1 in 10 to 120 level, to be at the right time when the universe is in a briefly accelerating phase.
Is there a reason, are there reasonable people that proposed that second?
By the previous criterion, yes.
Okay. People with salaries are higher.
Yes. So here's a way to make the first one work. Something called k-essence. Get an energy density which evolves differently during the matter-dominated era and the radiation-dominated era. So here is different components of energy density as a function of the scale factor. Radiation goes as a to the minus 4, matter goes as a to the minus 3. So the radiation was dominating in the early universe, the matter dominates later on. Here is this k-essence field, which is just a scalar field with a funny kinetic term. So there's a scalar field with a function of phi multiplying a function of the gradient of phi, or of the covariant derivative of phi. And if you pick these two functions correctly, you can get interesting behavior. The interesting behavior is that during the radiation-dominated era, the energy density in phi goes down as a to the minus 4. So if it was, say, 1 10 to the 4th times the radiation component, it would stay like that forever until this point where the matter began to equal the radiation. And then what happens is the field jiggles a little bit and settles down to a tracker solution in which it does not change in energy density. It's an approximately constant energy density from then on. So this behavior is exactly what you want. You want a scalar field which will do exactly that, which will go away during the radiation era, be low during the crossover, and then catch up and take over today. The problem is that I don't even think I could fit onto the transparency the actual forms of f of phi and g of grad phi squared that were chosen in order to make this happen. If you start writing down, in some sense, generic forms of these functions, you don't get any nice behavior whatsoever. You really have to pick very funny-looking potentials here. So for example, they tried something like G being the square root of 1 plus grad phi squared, and they mentioned the words Born-Infeld. That didn't work, so they tried the square root of 1 plus grad phi squared plus 0.03 times grad phi to the fourth plus 0.0089 times, and then they got something that worked. And you said, well, okay. 1 over phi or 1 over phi squared, something like that.
If you extrapolate that too far back like that, you wouldn't get inflation,
right? Well, we didn't include any inflationary thing here. Inflation is, I don't like to think of inflation as having anything to do with this stuff. You can always take anything that I've said here and add on to it an extra scalar field which would be good for inflation. The other possibility was the oscillating dark energy, that the acceleration of the universe is just something that happens from time to time. So here is a pretty clever mechanism. Have a field with a potential that looks like a tracker, like e to the minus phi, but then put bumps and wiggles on top of it. Okay? So times e to the minus phi times 1 plus a small number times the sine of phi, for example. So here's what phi is doing. It's wiggling about the solution it would have if it were tracking. And here is omega phi, the proportion of the energy density which is in this scalar field. And you see that it oscillates with this quasi-periodic kind of behavior. Sometimes it gets as high as 0.8 or 0.9, sometimes as low as 0.1. And this is on a log scale with the scale factor here. So the nice thing about this is that the periodicity is not some interval in time, some interval in log of the scale factor. So nucleosynthesis is at 10 to the minus 9, right here. And then you only had a 10% difference in what the universe was doing. The CMB is 10 to the minus 3, so that's here. And once again, only 10% of what the universe was doing. So these are the only two times we have any observational data, except right now, and once again, it's just begun to take over. The problem is, once again, you have to kind of pick some funny parameters in there, but it's not so bad. Something like this. Well, I mean, only because I've set other things equal to 1. I mean, there's a parameter there, there's a parameter there, the parameter there. So I think they have three parameters right here that they actually, when all is said and done. And you see, I mean, 4.98 to 0.51, not so bad, not so good. It's okay. All right. Those are the only thing I have to do with ideas to play with the dynamics of the dark energy. Let's see about testing any of these ideas. One point is that the dark energy, like I said before, has no right to be completely dark. You can't help that it would couple at least a little bit to other standard model fields. So here is a phi field, a quintessence field, and here are two photons. And you might say, I just don't put any terms in my Lagrangian which couple the phi field to the photons. But the problem is, phi couples to gravity, and photons couple to gravity, so you should have loops in here representing quantum gravity, which might be massive string states or virtual black holes or something like that. So for any of you people who have been wondering for a long time what quantum gravity looks like, it's a shiny gray ellipsoid. It looks like that. And the effect of these interactions in our low energy field theory is that you should get things of order 1 over M Planck, phi times the Maxwell Lagrangian. This would couple the phi field to photons, and you could go look for that coupling. It would show up in two places. It shows up in fifth force experiments, because phi is basically massless. Within the solar system, you would never detect the mass of phi. It should give a long-range force that you can detect in the lab. And also, phi is gradually changing with time. So because this is the Maxwell Lagrangian for electromagnetism, as phi changes, this coefficient slowly changes, and you would detect that as a change in the charge of the electron, or a change in the fine structure constant, alpha. Once again, there are strong limits on things like that, so you can go look for them. In order to squelch those two effects, this dimensionless number beta, which you might expect to be of order unity, has to be less than 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 5 or something like that. So we are surprised that we haven't yet detected it. On the other hand, maybe we have detected it. There is a claim out there that the fine structure constant is slowly varying. We've detected it to be so. So this claim is based on looking at hyperfine structure in different atomic transitions in high redshift absorption systems. So this is redshift between 0.5 and 3. These are Lyman alpha clouds in between us and some very distant quasar. And you look at the relative spacing of different spectral features, which the overall spacing would be linear in alpha, but then you wouldn't be able to distinguish that from just a different redshift for the object. But the relative spacing goes as alpha squared, and that is a detectable thing. So the claim is that if you look at very high resolution spectra from the Keck telescope and compare them to rest frame wavelengths measured in the laboratory, that at redshifts between, say, 1 and 3, alpha was different from its current value by a factor of minus 1 times 10 to the minus 5. It was one part in 100,000 different than it is today.
We had a colloquium here several months ago.
So
the speaker made it sound very convincing.
Yeah, well, so I'm going to try to undo that damage. So there is a competing limit on the value of alpha changing in time from the Oklo Natural Reactor. So this is a nice French mining engineer pointing at a deposit of radioactive elements in a mine in Gabon in Western Africa. And the point is that 2 billion years ago, the percentage of uranium-235 in naturally occurring uranium was much higher than it is today. So the uranium that was just lying around was automatically enriched. And in this mine, there was precipitation onto some stalactite or something like that, or stalagmite, I can never remember which one, of different concentrations of uranium, and there's just enough water around there to slow down the neutrons and so forth. And there was the first ever on Earth self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction. The second one was across the street from my office in Chicago when Enrico Fermi did it a few years ago. But you know that this happened because you can now go back and measure the relative isotopic abundances of the reaction products. So in particular, and this is the time when I fool you into thinking that I have some clue what I'm talking about when I talk about this nuclear physics, you measure the isotopic abundances of samarium, 147 versus 149. In naturally occurring samarium, the 147 and 149 isotopes are in approximately equal concentration. In Oklo, samarium 149 is only 2% of the amount of samarium 147. And that's because there is a way that samarium 149 can capture a slowly moving neutron and turn into 150. But the reaction energy is extremely small. So if you change any of the nuclear physics just a little bit, you either will greatly increase or greatly decrease the capture cross-section for samarium 149 into 150. And therefore, this isotopic abundance measured in the mine today tells you what the fine structure constant was, among many other constants, 2 billion years ago, 1.8 billion years ago. The answer is that it's the same as it is today to within 1 part in 10 to the minus 7. And there's just a claim that it changed by 1 part in 10 to the 5. Yes? You don't like this.
You can possibly know what happens to the structure of the samarium whenever you change alpha by a little bit.
It's just electromagnetic corrections to the nuclear masses.
No, it's a Coulomb barrier.
Yeah.
That's why it's so sensitive.
I think it's a Coulomb barrier.
Oh, our speaker.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Our speaker mentioned this also.
Fair enough.
And has there been a modern
Yes, this claim is from a couple years ago.
No.
Yes.
Dyson's work was from 20 years ago.
Well, no.
This paper is from...
He might have worked about 10.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was not involved in the original analysis.
Has there been a reanalysis by somebody without a stake and we can confirm the previous analysis?
You're welcome to go ahead. I mean, knock yourselves out. No, other people have looked at it, no one claims that it has changed.
But the quasar data doesn't show much change in the progression of things at once.
Right. So if you believe everything at once, this is what you have to believe. Now, you might not believe everything at once. It's very possible that you have some objection to the Oklo data in particular. But if you want to believe it, here's what you have to believe. Here are the individual quasars. The previous plot I showed you had binned the data because then it looks much nicer. But the individual quasars look like this. And the claim is that at 1 part in 10 to the minus 5, things have changed at redshifts between 0.5 and 2.5. And Oklo says that at a redshift of 0.2 or 0.1, things have not changed to the factor of 10 to the minus 7. So the question is, can you find a curve which goes through these data points at 1 part in 10 to the 5 level and then stops, and so it does not change between redshift of 0 and 0.1? And the answer is probably you could if you really, really tried, but it's not what you would expect. It's not the most obvious thing. So this is ongoing research, you know, how to try to quantify exactly how much you have to bend over backwards to make this happen. What else could you do? You could say the fine structure constant is not varying with time, and this constant, beta, which should have been of order 1, is really small. Well, how can you make that happen? And here's how you make that happen. You imagine the scalar field enjoys an approximate global symmetry. Phi goes to pi plus a constant. Then you get a pseudo-Goldstone boson, and you naturally explain both the smallness of the mass and the smallness of the couplings. The only reason I'm pointing this out here is because the potential that you then get is the potential for the brim of a Mexican hat, which you have slightly tilted by a little bit. So it looks like a cosine potential for phi, which looks nothing like those tracker potentials that I showed you before. So there's a brief period of time when the observers were brainwashed into thinking that the observed, that quintessence and tracker potentials were the same thing. But that's not true. You can get any sort of behavior here in terms of an effective W parameter or some time dependence, depending on where you start your field in the potential. So for the observers, the lesson is, go out and measure whatever you can measure, and we'll come up with the model once you've done it. I'm not even going to go through these. Just want to remind you that even though I've been talking about slowly rolling scalar fields, that is also not coincident with the idea of a dynamical dark energy. There's other things you can throw in there. Topological defects, dark matter with time-dependent masses, ultra-short wavelength modes, or some renormalization effect of quantum field theory and curved space-time. Okay, then the final possibility, with for which I have even less to say but than the previous possibilities, is maybe Einstein was wrong. Maybe the Friedman equation is not right, or something dramatic is happening with gravity on very large scales. So how could this happen? Plenty of ways. Extra dimensions are one way that could happen. There could be scalar fields that are non-minimally coupled to gravity. There could be some interesting quantum gravity effect, which is giving rise to a holographic relationship between the metric on large scales and the energy density on small scales. I don't know. Any one of these might be possible. None of these have been proposed which would really solve any of the problems we're introducing, but we don't have any good solutions, so they're still worth looking at. What we can do in the meantime is test the Friedman equation. We can ask whether or not we have some observational empirical data in favor of Einstein's prediction for the relationship between the expansion rate and the energy density. And the best way to test is using Big Bang nucleosynthesis, because all the other tests you can do about the Friedman equation, trying to measure the expansion rate as a function of some energy density, would also depend on the value or the relationship of gravity on smaller scales. Like the microwave background fluctuations involve the local concentrations that come together to make those anisotropies. But nucleosynthesis is really a purely homogeneous thing. It only depends on the expansion rate, so that's good. So here's the conventional story of nucleosynthesis. At temperatures above 1 MeV, the weak interactions are going rapidly. So neutrons and protons are interconverting. They're in thermal equilibrium with each other. At 1 MeV, the weak interactions freeze out. So neutrons and protons are stuck. They no longer convert into each other. But as the universe cools from 1 MeV to 80 keV, the neutrons are decaying. This takes a matter of a few seconds. The neutron lifetime is a matter of a few minutes, so they're comparable. And the neutron to proton ratio goes from 1 neutron per 6 protons at the beginning to 1 neutron per every 7 protons at 80 keV. Then at that temperature, 80 keV, suddenly the neutrons and the protons can smash together to form deuterium, and the deuterium will not be instantly destroyed by all the photons that are around. So deuterium can survive at that temperature, but deuterium doesn't want to survive. It wants to smash into other deuterium and turn to helium. So basically, at 80 keV, all of the neutrons you have around get converted into helium-4, to first approximation. To second approximation, there are trace amounts left over of deuterium, helium-3, and lithium. And the deuterium and lithium, at any rate, are things that we can observe, as well as the helium-4. So what would happen if you changed the Friedman equation, if you changed early universe cosmology? And the rule of thumb is, if you increase the Hubble parameter — this is the Hubble parameter, not hydrogen or anything like that — then you make more helium. For example, if you increase the Hubble parameter, there'd be less time for neutrons to decay. Also, you would freeze out at a higher temperature. And it's the low temperature here of 1 MeV that means that the neutrons and protons are not approximately equal. There's only 1 neutron per 6 protons, because it's the difference of the mass difference compared to the temperature. So the temperature goes up, the mass difference relative to the temperature goes down, and you get approximately equal numbers of neutrons and protons. So if you do something to the Friedman equation that increases the expansion rate, you increase the amount of helium, which provides you a constraint on what the universe was doing when it was a matter of seconds old. So here are the results. This is it's not a very easy to read plot, but I've plotted here the Hubble parameter versus the scale factor, going from today to 10 to the minus 10. The red curve is the predicted standard model. So you see in the radiation-dominated era, it goes as a to the minus 2. In the matter-dominated era, it goes as a to the minus 3 halves. And then if the cosmological constant takes over, it becomes a constant. The Hubble constant will stop evolving. Here are the set of curves which tell you what alternative histories would give you the same light element abundances, the same abundances of helium, deuterium, and lithium as we observe today. And so we've blown up that little plot right here. So we've just fit straight lines because it's not over a very large range that we care about what's going on. So just to parameterize all the possibilities, we fit a straight line through them on a log-log plot. So we look at power law evolution. And the answer is that, of course, the standard model works. There is a set of other models that work, but only a finely tuned set, in the sense that if you increase the Hubble constant at the beginning, at the freeze-out of the weak interactions, you have to then correspondingly decrease it at the end, at nucleosynthesis itself. So overall, even though the Hubble constant does not have to follow the same track as it does in the conventional cosmological scenario, it has to more or less average out to doing exactly that. So in particular, something where the universe is doing this during nucleosynthesis is ruled right out. There's just no way that can happen. And this is vivid evidence that the universe has done something strange recently. What the supernova observations are telling you is that right now, the slope of this plot is extremely shallow. The universe has a Hubble constant which is not changing very rapidly in time. But between now and nucleosynthesis, it must be pretty conventional to go between that point and these points right here. You could imagine some very strange thing that would go down there and then up there and down there like that, and there's no way to rule that out. We don't have any empirical data about what happens in that regime, but it would be weird. Now, of course, the statement that things would be weird does not have a very good track record of ruling things out in cosmology, but
is
it's...
there some statement about how fast the black curves have to go back to the red curve? Yes, snap back to the red curve, right?
Well, we only have data here, at the CMB,
right,
and here.
Oh, I see.
So between here and here, it can do anything.
Anything could happen.
Anything. Not that it does, but it could. All right, so the final provocative possibility that I will mention is, just to be complete, the nucleosynthesis constraint tells you about cosmology or Einstein's equations on length scales given by the Hubble radius, but the Hubble radius at nucleosynthesis, which is a physical length scale of about a few astronomical units, so not very big. If you had a theory in which the general relativity consistently broke down at the Hubble radius, this would test that theory. If, on the other hand, you had a theory which general relativity only broke down at some fixed dimensionful parameter, which was equal to the Hubble radius today of 10 to the 10 billion light years, 10 billion light years, then this would not test that at all, because the nucleosynthesis length scales are much smaller than that. So maybe general relativity breaks down at a certain dimensionful parameter given by the current Hubble radius. Maybe even you could get rid of both the dark matter and the dark energy. So I'll give you the motivation for doing this, but I won't tell you how to do it because I don't know how to do it. The motivation comes from Milgram, who points out, where do you need dark matter to explain the behavior of galaxies? And there's no length scale over which you need dark matter. Dark matter appears at very different length scales. But if you calculate the Newtonian acceleration due to gravity, less than which you need dark matter to explain the dynamics, you always get the same number in every system you look at, 10 to the minus 18th inverse seconds. It happens to be true, even though this has to do with bound systems like the Milky Way and things that have nothing to do with the cosmological expansion, that this dimensionful parameter is also the Hubble parameter today, which is the Hubble parameter at which the universe apparently starts accelerating. So the pipe dream is that you come up with some new theory of gravity which has one dimensionful parameter in it, which is that, and that new theory of gravity explains both the acceleration of the universe and the rotation curves of galaxies, as well as, of course, gravitational lensing and all the other phenomena, the microwave background, everything we know about cosmology. That will be an improvement over this preposterous situation we have. But no one has such a theory, even though very smart people have tried. So to the extent to which that's discouraging, I would not encourage you to follow it up. Probably this actually is just a coincidence. Or even there's claims, for instance, by Kapling, Hatton, Turner, that they can take a cold dark matter model and derive this number from an ordinary cold dark matter model without invoking any new physics whatsoever. So that might also be true. That would be the less interesting possibility. Well, the conclusions such as they are, something's going on. It's dark and mysterious. That's why the background color is black for this whole talk. And that's why, yes. Well, this is the ITP style, I was told, so. The best fit, a perfectly good fit, is just the fit that we've had all along. A cosmological constant, omega lambda equals 0.7, omega matter equals 0.3. Here it is. It's the blue part here. It's not doing anything. It fits the data fine. It's just not very natural. We could also make this blue part dynamical, make it changing with time in some interesting way. So far, the attempts that have been made to do that have not improved the naturalness qualities at all, but nevertheless, they are observationally testable, so we still think about other possibilities. The good news, for what it's worth, is that these are both fascinating theoretical problems and amenable to different observational constraints. So something interesting is going to be learned, either about particle physics or about gravity, or at the very least about cosmology. Thank you.
Saying that one has to worry because these three numbers are same order of magnitude in the pie chart. But a lot of the models you described with also parameters in this order of unity. So why bother?
Because, well, so there's two separate issues. One issue is the blue versus the everything else, and the other issue is the red versus the yellow. Because the blue is dark energy, the red and yellow are matter. So for the blue versus the matter, the dark energy versus the matter, you have a time-dependent question. So you can't put a parameter in your Lagrangian, which is equal to unity, and claim that you've solved the problem, because you have to, it also depends on when you're looking. And that's very hard to understand. For the red versus the yellow, for non-baryonic dark matter versus ordinary stuff, the point is there's not a parameter in your Lagrangian which has the proportion of non-baryonic dark matter to the proportion of baryons. Both of those come from complicated processes, which as far as we understand have nothing to do with each other, that involve not only the parameters from Lagrangian, but also the history of the universe. So there's some coincidence that you have some huge function with a lot of parameters, and some other huge function with a lot of other parameters, and their values are equal.
So are you saying the three parameters of this other explanation are the order of magnitude one, or the same order of magnitude, the natural thing?
No, I don't have any good explanations for this. I'm not saying that I've explained it away. It's still a puzzle as far as I can tell.
Questions?
One more question. You've plotted the graph where you went from omega equals 1 to omega lambda equals 1. And you said this is rapid increase and why we are in this state part. Why isn't the, I don't understand how you plot that, why isn't the time scale for that transition of the public?
It is.
Then why is that problem? Why couldn't we make, or how did it scale
the Hubble? I mean, because the Hubble time changes with time. I mean, why is it today's Hubble time that you've chosen to look at? It doesn't make sense to talk about the number of seconds over which this transition happens. The thing that makes sense is to ask over what factor has the universe expanded while this transition is happening? And the answer is less than a factor of 2 or 3. But the universe has expanded overall by a factor of, you know, 10 to the 20th. So that's a very large fine-tuning. You have to do it on a log scale is the short way. You can't, linear scale is not fair because everything is, the volume is a power law.
We have a question from a student.
When you mentioned
well, the first thing they predict is that the change in alpha should be of order 1. So that's a problem. So maybe there's some fine-tuning in some parameter there. If you fine-tune it so that alpha changes by a factor of 10 to the minus 5 over a cosmological time scale, there's no definite prediction about whether or not the rate of change is increasing or decreasing with time. So, but it's very hard to understand why the rate of change of alpha should have decreased by a factor of 10, which is what you need. So alpha changed by 10 to the minus 5 over redshift of 1, 10 to the minus 7 over redshift of 0.1. So it slowed down.
So like 8 to the 4 or something like that.
You could do it.
Okay.
I don't want to say you can't do it.
So there's no prediction?
No. Because different models of quintessence will have different predictions. Some have phi going faster as the universe expands, and therefore delta alpha. Some have it the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Feel free to ask questions, or comments, objections. Okay, well, let's thank the speaker again.